Well, good morning, everyone. But today we're going to be continuing in the book of Esther. The title of this series is The Hidden Hand of God. It's the one book in the Bible that actually never mentions God by name in it. And yet, if you look just under the surface, you see God at work throughout it. As I get this message started, I want to ask you a question. As you go through your life and you take in entertainment, interact with coworkers, talk to family, watch the news, engage in your community and your neighborhood, do you ever feel as a follower of Christ that's trying to do the right thing in God's eyes like you're a minority, like you're out of place, like that you're odd, that you just don't quite fit in into society? I feel that way at times. Right now, for the last 3 months, I've been working as an interim director at a property management company in Bellingham. And it's the first time in 30 years that I'm working in a non-religious environment. And I got to tell you, I feel a little bit odd in my workplace. My language is a little bit different than the language of the people around me. I've been told that actually the language has gotten better since I got there, which is interesting. But I was not excited to go to the happy hour time that they were having on Thursday night. So there are these things that are just different for me. And in my workplace right now, what I'm trying to do is I am trying to do the right thing in God's eyes and to represent Him well and to do what He would have me to do. And what I'm finding is sometimes that is well received within the work environment. And the people I'm working with or working for, they really appreciate the fact that I'm doing that. Other times, it seems like nobody really cares. And then there are those other times where for me to do the right thing in God's eyes actually seems to cause some problems for the people around me. And that becomes hard. Have you ever experienced that? I have. So if you ever feel that way, you also probably felt the pressure to compromise and to say, well, can I just go along to get along? You know, I don't want to have my desire to do the right thing leave other people in a difficult spot. I don't want to disappoint them, and I don't want to deal with consequences that come from that. If you've ever felt that way, I think there's a lot of parallels between what we're beginning to experience in this story in Esther and what we experience in our life. That there's a lot of parallels in that. You see, the story of Esther, just to recap a little bit, the nation of Israel is in a time where it is no longer a nation, it's no longer residing in a country. It is a group of people now that they go from being Israelites to being Jews because now they're an ethnic group that's dispersed in another nation. They've been taken into captivity. They are basically like refugees in a way. And they're in a foreign land. And most of them are just trying to live out their faith the best way they can in a land that does not understand their God, does not understand their God's ways. And they're trying to keep their head down to some degree in terms of not getting themselves in trouble with the governing authorities. And it seemed like they were doing everything just to just get along. But here's the rub. When you do the right thing in God's eyes, it's always going to get you noticed. It may be in a good way, and it may be in a bad way. And doing the right thing does not always impress people and get their admiration, as we will see in today's passages. So today we're going to be looking at a little bit more about Mordecai. He's one of the three main characters in the Bible, or in this story. And Mordecai, one thing you're going to see, a defining characteristic of his life, is he seems to be a guy that wants to do the right thing in God's eyes. And today we're going to take a look at three ways that he does this in this story. The first way, I'm just going to jump into because we kind of covered it last week in looking at chapter 2. And the first thing that we see about him trying to do the right thing in God's eyes is how he comes alongside and he takes in his young cousin named Esther and raises her as his own. Now, we know that that's the right thing in God's eyes because God cares for the orphan. Esther apparently had lost her parents, as the scripture says, and now her older cousin Mordecai takes her in and he raises her as his own daughter. Now, Don't minimize that, because that's actually a difficult thing probably to do during this time. They were refugees in this land. They were not likely rich and had lots of means and to be able to support an extra child. And yet, Mordecai says, what's the right thing to do? The right thing is to take her in and raise her as our own. And he does that. And the results from doing the right thing is, man, he got blessed. I mean, this young girl he takes into his home grows up to be a woman who has the favor of God in her life, as Ryan talked about last week. You know, she is a beautiful both on the inside and the outside. And she ultimately goes to become the queen of the country. What a blessing that came because he was willing to do the right thing in the eyes of God. I was thinking about that there are those times where we choose to do the right thing, and even though it's difficult, even though it's hard, even though we don't know what the end result's going to be, that sometimes it turns out to be an incredible blessing. One of the stories that came to my mind this week was actually thinking about my oldest daughter, Sarah, when she was a teenager. And one of the things that Sarah liked to do is she was actually, as a teenager and even preteen, she was in a dance troupe, a Christian one, where they were doing dance as a part of worship to just really represent God, and she loved it. She was in this great dance troupe in Longview, Washington, and then we moved to Eugene, Oregon, and we found another one. And so she got involved in that, and she was about 13 years old at the time, and the lady that was leading it was a Christian, and she said she wanted to really honor Christ through this dance troupe, and so they were doing things, but she started to shift in terms of the music that they were doing, and Sarah became really uncomfortable with the moves and the music that there was being there. She goes, I want to do this as worship, and I feel like I'm doing things that are more provocative. And so she wanted to quit. And I suggested that the right thing to do would be to go and tell her instructor why that she was going to quit. And so at 13, she did that. She went and did a really difficult thing to go and tell an adult that, you know what, I don't like the direction things are going, and this is my heart for dance, and I don't want to be a part of that. And she did that. And it was the next day I got a call from the lady that headed up the troop. She goes, you have no idea what Sarah's words did to me overnight. She goes, I was up a lot during the night praying about this. And she says, I realized that I have fallen away from the vision that God gave me for this. And I've compromised myself. And Sarah will never know what the words that you said, how much that made a difference for me. You see, that happens at times when we do the right thing. That God uses it, and there's this immediate blessing that comes from it, even when it's difficult. But we also see in the story of Mordecai a second act of him doing the right thing in God's eyes that actually doesn't really seem to generate anything. In Esther chapter 2, verses 21 through 23, we read this. One day, as Mordecai was on duty at the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, who were guards at the door of the king's private quarters, became angry at King Xerxes and plotted to assassinate him. But Mordecai heard about the plot and gave the information to Queen Esther. She then told the king about it and gave Mordecai credit for the report. When an investigation was made and Mordecai's story was found to be true, the two men were impaled on a sharpened pole. This was all recorded in the book of the history of the kings of Xerxes' reign. You know, I imagine that this was a difficult thing for Mordecai to deal with. He hears about a plot against the king, and then he must decide what he is to do. What is the right thing? Well, we know that the right thing in God's eyes is that murder is wrong. And he has been given information that can prevent a murder from happening. But I imagine he might have wrestled with this a little bit, because the king was not a good and godly man. In fact, if it was a democracy that he was a part of, I'm sure that Mordecai would not have voted for the king. He may not have wanted the king to continue to be married to Esther. He may not have wanted to get involved, and maybe he was worried that people wouldn't have believed him. He may not have wanted to actually report this because he didn't know how high it went. And by revealing this plot, he might himself find himself in trouble and people coming after him. And by reporting what was going on, It meant that he might be getting involved and being noticed, something that he seems reluctant to do. But what does he do? He does the right thing. And what happens? What reward does he get for it? Nothing. Nothing happens. It gets marked down in the daily journals of the king. That's it. They find out what's going on, they take care of it, and they completely forget about him. You know, there are times when we do the right thing that nothing good seems to come from it. But it's still the right thing to do. Have you ever fought through your fears and insecurities and done the right thing in a big way, at least a big way for you, and seemingly got nothing out of it? It happens. About 12 or 13 years ago, there was a young man that was coming to our church. I was getting to know him and meeting with him and a couple other people. He was coming out of drug addiction. He was living in poverty. He was he'd been clean and sober for only a couple months, and his mom died. And we were in Eugene, Oregon. His mom had lived in Yakima. He wanted to get there. He didn't have a vehicle. He didn't have even the money to get there. I wanted him to be able to go there, make the arrangements, deal with the things that needed to be dealt with. And I wanted to help him stay clean and sober during that, because these are the times that people oftentimes relapse. And so I offered to take a couple days off from work and drive him up to Yakima and spend those days with him. Hopefully my presence there would just give him something else to rely upon than turning to the drugs that he'd always been a part of. And so we got in the car. We drove to Yakima. It was a little awkward at times. I'm not used to people that smoke all the time, and he chain smoked. And and so my car smelled like smoke. That was an unusual thing for me. We got to the hotel room. We did a couple of things in the community. His stepbrother showed up and was staying in the same hotel we were at. And when it was time to kind of go to bed, I got ready for bed. He goes, well, I'm just going to go hang out with my stepbrother for a little while. Great. He came back, and he was high. I found out that he got high not off the drugs that his stepbrother brought, but he got high off the drugs that he had brought in my car across state lines with me. And we ended up going home, and I wondered the whole time, did I really do anything of value? To this day, I don't know if I did. But was it the right thing to do? It was still the right thing to do. To this day, I would say, yeah, that's the thing you're supposed to do. And here's the thing we need to realize is that sometimes we are called to do the right thing in God's eyes, and nothing will appear to come from it. If we're only doing the right thing because we're looking for the benefit or the reward, you know what? We're not going to see it sometimes. And then there's this third time that we see Mordecai doing the right thing. And instead of it leading to a reward or it leading to nothing, it actually leads to big problems for him and problems unimaginable for the people that he comes from. In Esther chapter 3, verses 1 through 4, we read this. He says, sometimes later, King Xerxes promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agite, over all the other nobles, making him the most powerful official in the empire. All the king's officials would bow down before Haman and show him respect whenever he passed by, for so the king had commanded. But Mordecai refused to bow down or show him respect. Then the palace officials at the gates, king's gate, asked Mordecai, why are you disobeying the king's command? They spoke to him day after day, but he still refused to comply with the order. So they spoke to him about Mordecai's conduct, since Mordecai had told him he was a Jew. Who's this Haman? This is the fourth major character that's a part of the story. And who is he? Well, we read here that he is a noble, that the king was so impressed with him that he elevates him above all the other nobles. He's the second most powerful person in the nation. What else do we learn about him? Well, as we continue to read forward, and I'm going to pull some information from later chapters, we learn a little bit about his character and what type of man he was. He was egotistical and he was narcissistic. Haman's self-worth is entirely tied to public validation. When Mordecai refuses to bow to him, Haman's fragile ego, it's shattered. You ever know anybody like that? The text notes that despite his immense wealth and power, and family status, none of it mattered as long as he had to see Mordecai at the king's gates refusing to honor him. And not only do we see that, but we see a guy that's deeply insecure and vindictive. We're going to read in a moment what Haman does, but in anger, his anger is completely disproportionate to the problem at hand. Rather than dealing with Mordecai individually, we're going to read that his insecurities cause him to seek the destruction of a whole ethnic group. And you know what else about his character? He's a master manipulator. We're going to see that in the next part of the text we read. But man, he's a political mastermind, and he knew how to work the system to get what he wanted. He is not a good man. And beyond that, we read that he is an Agite. And that doesn't really mean much to us, and it didn't mean anything to me when I read it the first time. But the title Agite is much more than just a family surname. To the ancient Israelite listener, it was a massive literary and historical red flag. It was to tell him that there was something about his people and where he came from that they should be aware of, and they would have identified it. By identifying Haman as an Agite, the book of Esther explicitly frames the conflict between Haman and Mordecai as something beyond just two people having a disagreement. This is a centuries-old blood feud that's been going on between the Israelites and a group of people known as the Malachites that would later become the Agites. You see, if you go back 400 years earlier, when Israel is coming out of Egypt and they're heading into the Promised Land, the Amalekites attack them in a cowardly ambush, and they take out the vulnerable and the weak people that at the end of their columns that they're marching in, and they become arch enemies to the nation of Israel. You fast forward 200 years, and you get to the time of King Saul, and you find that the Amalekites, under their king by the name of Agag, attack Israel to destroy Israel. And God gives King Saul and the Israelites this victory. And eventually, not only are they defeated, but King Agag is killed as well. Apparently, though, some of his descendants lived on, and they became known as the Agites. And so now fast forward 200 more years, and here we are in Susa in Assyria, and you got Haman, an Agite, descendant of King Agag, in a conflict with Mordecai, a Jew, by the way, from the tribe of Benjamin, which happens to be the same tribe that King Saul came from, that defeated his great-great-grandfather. There's a little bit going on in this, isn't there? And so you see this rage that is in Haman to not just take care of Mordecai, but to wipe out all the Jews. This was not a nice man. And so when the order comes down from the king that says to all the people, including Mordecai, you are to bow and honor this man, Haman, Mordecai goes, no, that is not the right thing to do in God's eyes. To honor and show worship and respect for a person like this. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of if you were living in Nazi Germany and Hitler comes along. And you are called to honor him. And you say, no way, I am not going to bow, or I'm not going to do the thing with my hand raised up and say the words, because this man is not a good man. And I'm not going to honor that. And so Mordecai doesn't. And what's the result? Well, the result is not blessing, and the result is not nothing. The result is worse than anyone would have predicted. Starting in verse 5 of chapter 3, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not bow down or show him respect, he was filled with rage. He had learned of Mordecai's nationality, right? He's a Jew, archenemy. So he decided it was not enough to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Instead, he looked for a way to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire empire of Xerxes. By the way, is this sounding a little bit more about that Nazi Germany comparison? This is not the first time that the Jews have been threatened to be wiped out by somebody. Verse 7, so in the month of April, during the 12th year of King Xerxes' reign, lots were cast in Haman's presence. The lots were called the Purim. And by the way, they make note of that because there's a holiday that comes up as a result of this called Purim, to determine the best day and month to take action. and the day selected was March 7th, nearly a year later. Then Haman approached King Xerxes and said, "There's a certain race of people scattered through all the provinces of your empire who keep themselves separate from everyone else. Their laws are different from those of any other people, and they refuse to obey the laws of the king. So it's not in the king's interest to let them live. If it pleases the king, issue a decree that they be destroyed. And, oh, by the way, I'll give you 10,000 large sacks of silver to the government administrators to be deposited in the royal treasury." Master manipulator. And the king, who's not necessarily a good man himself, agreed, confirming his decision by removing his signet ring from his finger and giving it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said, "The money and the people are both yours to do with as you see fit." So on April 17th, the king's secretaries were summoned, and a decree was written exactly as Haman dictated. It was sent to the king's highest officers, the governors of the respective provinces, and the nobles of each province in their own script and languages, so that nobody would misunderstand what's being said. The decree was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. Dispatches were sent by swift messengers into all the provinces of the empire, giving the order that all Jews, young and old, including women and children, must be killed, slaughtered, and annihilated on a single day. This was scheduled to happen on March 7th of the next year. The property of the Jews would be given to those who killed them. I find the parallels between this and the Holocaust to be amazing. A copy of this decree was to be issued as law in every province and proclaimed unto all people so that they would be ready to do their duty on the appointed day. At the king's command, and the decree went out by swift messengers, and it was also proclaimed in the fortress of Susa. And then the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa fell into confusion. What in the world is going on? I want to take us back to Mordecai. What was the result for him doing the right thing in this situation? It got really bad. He makes the second most powerful man in the country angry with him. He doesn't just endanger his own life, but his actions result in the death sentence to all of his people. I want you to just imagine for a second, you are Mordecai, and that decree has just been issued. What are you thinking, and what are you feeling? Are you wondering, should I have done that? Maybe I should have just bowed down to him. Maybe I should have just found a way to make it work. Maybe I should have just found a way to go along so that I could get along. What were the people, his people, saying to him when they found out why this all happened? Man, you shouldn't have antagonized him. You should have just done what you were supposed to do and what you were commanded to do. Maybe he was even thinking, this isn't what's supposed to happen when you do the right thing. Maybe he was asking the question, what is God? Where is God in all of this? I did the right thing. And now I'm going to die, and all of my people are going to die. There's a truth here I don't want us to miss, because it's easy to miss in our culture and our cultural's view of Christianity. And the view of Christianity oftentimes is that you do the right thing, you're going to be blessed, right? But the truth of the matter is that we live in a broken world with many people who do not like or care about what God says is right or wrong. And when we refuse to follow our culture's values and beliefs and instead choose to do what's right in God's eyes, not everybody's going to like it. Not everybody's going to say, oh, that was great you did that. Sometimes they're going to be upset about that. And the question is when that happens, what are we going to do? Are we going to make the choice to go along to get along? Or are we going to make the choice that we're going to do what's right in God's eyes, No matter whether we get rewarded right away, whether people, you know, do nothing with it, or whether or not it's going to have severe consequences for us and others. How do we do that? I think we've got to be committed to not giving up on doing the right thing. And when we experience the consequences from doing the right thing, that we look to God for his comfort and his help, because he knows what it's like to suffer for doing the right thing. We have a great symbol for that. It's a cross where Jesus did the right thing by humanity, and he still had to suffer for an ultimate good. And the last thing I think of is, I think we need to have faith in the hidden hand of God to bring justice at some point in time to our circumstance. You see, we're not always going to see the reward right away. And you know what? I imagine Mordecai at the moment when this decree is made, and he's going to have to wait 11 months now to figure out what God's going to do. And can you imagine 11 months waiting for a group of people of your neighbors to come and kill you and take all your stuff? How horrible that must have been. But we know the rest of the story. And you know what's really interesting in the rest of the story? The hidden hand of God is already at work. He's already been laying the foundation for the salvation of his people. He's already been laying this foundation of something good coming from this act of doing the right thing. What is he doing? Well, through Mordecai's first act of doing the right thing, this young woman has become queen in the nation. Through his second act of thwarting the plot against the king, we're going to learn a little bit later that that comes back up, and actually he does get rewarded right at the right time to thwart the plans of Haman. The hidden hand of God is at work in his life. He can't probably see it right at this moment, but the hidden hand of God is going to bring a salvation to his people eventually. This is really a strange place to end this message, because I want to just jump right into the rest of the story, but this is where the passage ends. And you know what? I think that's a good place. And the reason for this is because waiting for God to move when we are experiencing the negative consequences of doing the right thing, I think is a part of living the life of faith. It's not always going to be instant gratification when we follow God and we do the right thing. That there will be moments we need to make. And just as the Jewish people had to wait 11 months for God to rescue them from the murderous plot of Haman and his friends, sometimes we have to wait to see the fruits of doing the right thing in God's eyes. I hope that what you take from this message is encouragement to do the right thing in God's eyes, no matter what it looks like or if it's going to be received or not. Because if you do, God will use it eventually. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for, in a world that doesn't believe in truth, that does not oftentimes believe that there are rights and wrongs, that it's all relative, that you are one that knows how life works, that you created this world and you created us, and you are willing to share with us the right and the wrong ways of doing things. And Lord, as we attempt to be people that live according to that right way and doing the right thing, no matter what the circumstances are or what the consequences might be, would you help us? Would you give us the strength and the abilities that you gave Jesus, who lived the perfect life and always did the right thing, even when it was really, really hard? Would you help us in the situations that we're wrestling with right now, where we're wrestling with, do we just go along to get along, or do we do the right thing and just take the consequences that come from that? Would you help us to do that? And then will you help us as a church body to support one another as we choose to do the right thing, to encourage one another when the consequences come, and to encourage one another to look for the hidden hand of God that's working behind the scenes to do something that we can't even imagine right now in the midst of dealing with the consequences that are coming from doing the right thing. Lord, help us to be representatives in this world, and whether people like it or not, it doesn't matter, but let us just earn your favor, and may you be pleased with the choices that we make. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.